This week, it was once considered a muddy-tasting river fish. Now, Murray cod is finding new fans in celebrity chefs and high-end restaurant diners. Why sweet black garlic is growing in popularity with the foodie set. And 30 years after their father started planting bamboo, a family is finding a market for the plant's edible shoots, pickled with ginger and turmeric. We'll also head to a special farm where animals are playing a role, not in producing meat or fleece, but in providing therapy.
We had a lady out here this morning and we were just brushing Ellie, and Ellie's almost falling asleep in this lady's arms, but then you also watch the lady's face and it changes as well, because she's now in the moment of, you know, wanting to get this donkey to sleep. So she's not thinking about, you know, the 110,000 things that she needs to go and do when she gets home, because that's making her mind race. She's now in the moment of working with the donkey. She wants to get the donkey to sleep. It's just beautiful to watch that.
The healing power of animals and how they're helping people with mental illness and autism spectrum disorders find a connection. That's coming up. First, though, let's head to a farm on the Sunshine Coast hinterland where a pioneering farmer started planting bamboo nearly three decades ago.
Between the rolling green ranges hugging the Mary River in Queensland's Sunshine Coast hinterland lies a forest you'd usually associate with Asia.
It really gets you. I love the sound. You can come down here. It's nice and peaceful and serene. Then the wind comes up and the bamboo starts to talk to you. It's got a language of its own. So you just stand there and listen. It's absolutely brilliant.
This Belleye Park farm is packed with bamboo species gathered from around the globe. It's the life work of bamboo expert Durnford Dart.
We've got 250-odd species here, and keeping track of them is a bit of a challenge.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Nichols, here with 80-year-old Durnford. With a small GPS device in hand, he's taking on the big job of collating his collection for his family.
So, gee, I'm getting on a bit. So that's why I'm marking up the GPS where all the species are, so if I cark, people will know where they're located.
He's plotting the position of each plant and when and where he sourced it.
This one here is what we call Dendrocanalus latifloris. It tells me here I bought the parent plant in Auckland, of all places, in 1992.
It's a big task. His 250 species are planted across 40 hectares.
Looks like you've got a bit of work to do.
Oh, yeah. Got three done now. We're slowly getting there.
Durnford Dart helped pioneer bamboo farming in Australia. Selling up in Sydney, he moved north in 1989 and, after much deliberation, settled on planting a spray-free crop that few other Aussies grew.
Having been in agriculture when I was a kid, where everybody grew the same thing, got nothing for it, and my poor old dad actually got bills for dumping his beans. So I thought that was my first lesson in agricultural economics.
This species is called Mozo, or Philostachys pubescens.
You'll start off at ground level, and in 6 weeks' time, so you're way up there, 25 metres tall.
For centuries, bamboo's been used for building in Asia.
Bamboo flooring is the second hardest timber in the world. Brazilian walnut's the only one that's harder.
But not enough's been planted to make a processing plant on the Sunshine Coast viable. He imports bamboo products like ply, composite flooring and fumigated treated poles from China and Vietnam. But sales of plants and fresh bamboo poles provide the farm's main income. Becky Dart grew up roaming free on the farm that she describes as paradise. But it wasn't until she studied for a Bachelor of Applied Science at the University of Queensland that she realised the unfulfilled potential of what her father had planted. Bamboo's a diet staple in many countries. Of 1,500 species, less than 300 produce shoots fit for humans to eat. And Becky's dad chose bamboos to produce timber and food.
So these ones are the ones we've classed as grade A shoots this morning.
After researching the environmental and nutritional benefits of bamboo, Becky decided to make the most of her father's foresight and revisit harvesting edible shoots from the groves. She founded Big Heart Bamboo.
Just all seemed to, fall into place, which was, really beautiful.
There are no pesticides, irrigation, or hormones involved.
Okay, so what we're doing here is we've got what we class as A-class shoots. So these are the ones that are primo and ready to go. So this one will be going into here, obviously. And then we've got other ones that are just a little bit too far gone in here. You can see they've gone a bit green there. So these ones that probably won't make the cut later on. We'll have a closer look at them.
Around 6 tonnes of shoots were harvested last year. Just 1/3 of each harvested shoot is soft and sweet enough to eat. Because the harvest seasons are short, Becky's been working on a value-adding option to keep money flowing in throughout the rest of the year. She hires out a commercial kitchen to pickle the bamboo shoots.
So we've just put the bamboo in for its first boil.
Fresh bamboo is bitter. It contains a natural form of cyanide to repel predators. And while pandas have adapted to safely eat raw bamboo, that generally isn't the case for humans.
And it actually has a natural toxin called taxophilin in it, which you want to get rid of when you're boiling it. So whenever you're eating bamboo, it's absolutely crucial that you boil it for at least 8 to 10 minutes and make sure that that bitter flavour's gone.
She uses apple cider vinegar, black pepper smoked over tea tree and red gum leaves, and fresh ingredients sourced from local organic and spray-free farmers in her pickling mix.
So we're just getting all the turmeric out of here, and this is all locally grown spray-free turmeric and ginger, and then we're going to mix that in with the honey. This is one thing we're really passionate about, is also like the healing benefits of food.
The pickled bamboo shoots are packed into sanitised jars, have a long shelf life and are sold through local retailers. Becky recommends adding them to salads for extra flavour and crunch. Back on the farm, agritourism and education now firmly on the family's agenda.
This has been my dad's legacy, essentially. He's spent most of his adult life building this place up, and, you know, he's put a lot of his heart and soul into this place, and I would love to see it keep going.
This is a fish that doesn't grow anywhere else in the world. In fact, it doesn't even grow anywhere else in Australia. So it's one of the rarest fish in the world. It only grows in the Murray-Darling Basin. There's almost nobody else producing it in any quantity. And so we're really lucky in the sense that we've got the best freshwater fish in the world, and it's also the rarest fish in the world.
Murray cod has long been a favourite freshwater fish for inland Australia. But now it's also winning fans further afield.
We've got restaurants like Wattle in Tokyo and Wayan in New York now taking regular shipments of Murray cod because they know they're getting something that nobody else in the world can get.
Ross Anderson is chairman of Murray Cod Australia, an aquaculture company that grows Murray cod in freshwater ponds in the New South Wales Riverina. It's not just restaurants in Japan and the United States who have taken an interest in the farmed fish. They're also proving popular with some of Australia's top chefs. And the company recently hosted a visit from celebrity chef Heston Blumenthal.
Some of the guys from Heston Blumenthal's organisation tasted the fish and told him about it. And he came down here and had a look at it. He loved the way we operate, you know, using the natural waters and the ecology that we balance things with and the beautiful quality that the fish produces. And after some to-ing and fro-ing, we ended up actually with Heston becoming a shareholder, which made us extremely happy.
Hi, I'm Cara Jeffrey. I'm chatting with Ross near some of the ponds where fish are grown to a size of 1.5 to 2 kilograms before being caught for sale. It's a system, Ross says, that impressed the celebrity chef.
Oh, look, he was really impressed by the way we balance the ecology in the water with algae, bacteria, protozoa, an ecology that actually keeps a really clean white fish. He loved that side of it. He loved the scientific aspects of how we can produce, using our specific technology that we use with the Acuna fish, we can produce a fish that actually has a better taste than one you'd catch in the wild. Those aspects really appealed to his attitude towards food and science, really.
And so did you take him out and feed him plenty of Murray cod while he was here?
We did. He came out here, he went through the ponds, he went through the science and the technology of how everything is done here. You know, he loved it so much that he ended up wanting to become a shareholder, which is marvellous for us.
And what is it about the fish that appeals so much?
It's got a really high gelatinous fat content, and they love the fact that the flesh doesn't dry out. It has a firm texture with a really creamy taste, and the way that it's produced here, it's absolutely pristine with the white flesh and the clean taste, unlike one that you might get out of the wild.
As well as tapping into international markets, Murray Cod Australia also has plans to expand its operation locally, including opening a processing factory, as the company's founder and managing director, Matt Ryan, explains.
Yeah, so we currently pack here just whole fish and they go out, you know, as a whole fish. That will still continue to do that because some of our customers want that and prefer that. But it'll just add another, I guess, another dimension to our sales profile. And we'll have, you know, filleted product, we'll have smoked product, and we're working on a couple of other products that we'll hopefully be able to release shortly.
You've spoken about export markets. What's the flavour and taste for Murray cod locally? Do many people enjoy eating it within the Riverina?
Yeah, certainly locally here in Griffith. We've got quite a few guys that are eating it now. We've got some quite avid fishermen that now buy off us regularly rather than catch their own, which is a good testament to the product. Here in Griffith, we've got sort of two or three high-end restaurants that are using the product regularly, which is good. And then, hopefully once we get our processing plant up and running, I think we'll be surprised to see how much domestic demand comes out of that as well.
Local chef Luke Piccolo has been serving the farmed Murray cod at his Griffith restaurant for several years. He was thrilled to meet the celebrity chef and watch him prepare the fish.
It was great working with Heston, and it was really cool to watch the way he approached the fish. He cooked it over his barbecue in some interesting ways. He wrapped it in hay and smoked it, which I hadn't seen before. Yeah, there was a few techniques that he did, and obviously he's got a bit of a quirky way of cooking, so I really enjoyed that.
And what was the Australian spin of cooking Murray cod and from the Riverina that you gave him?
We cooked it here in the restaurant in a bit more of a fine dining formal matter. And we actually served it four different ways to him over the course of the menu. So I think he really enjoyed the way we cooked it as well.
What's the favourite way that you enjoy eating Murray cod? What's your favourite way to enjoy it?
I actually really love cooking it in a camp oven. Obviously in the restaurant it's a bit different, but if you're out on the river and you put a whole fish in a camp oven and it just slightly steams and you make a beautiful sauce in that, I think it's quite ideal. There's nothing better than eating Murray cod by the Murrumbidgee River.
Luke says locally, perceptions about eating Murray cod are changing as people experience the farmed fish compared to river caught cod.
It's got a beautiful milky white flesh, really creamy texture and a mild flavour, so our clients really, really do love to eat it. We've seen a massive change over the last 3 years. There was a big perception with people that it was a muddy fish because they were used to eating the old river cod. But I think having this farm fish that does have a really mild, clean flavour, we've really changed the way people think about the fish.
Chef Luke Piccolo from Griffith in southern New South Wales. He recently cooked Murray cod with celebrity chef Heston Blumenthal, no pressure there, who has taken a share in a local aquaculture company growing the fish. Luke was speaking with our reporter, Cara Jeffrey. You're with a Country Breakfast on RN. Still to come, we'll meet the animals who are providing company and therapy for those who struggle in social settings. And it's described as being sweet like a lolly with a complex aftertaste. We're going to try aged black garlic.
This machine is producing black garlic. It takes ordinary white garlic and runs it through a prescriptive ageing process that turns it into a highly sought after sweet delicacy. But I can't tell you what this machine looks like. It's top secret. How do you make garlic black? Like, I realise this is a very, very big secret, tightly held. Can you give us a little bit of an insight?
Well, yeah, we can, as long as you don't share it with all your mates. But pretty much black garlic, it's a long process. We take 6 weeks to age our garlic, and it's a tight set of parameters controlling temperature and humidity in a nutshell, basically. But quite specific parameters we work in, but don't tell everybody.
Hi, I'm Simone Smith. I'm here with Mark Johnstone on his property near the Snowy River in Victoria's East Gippsland, where he has been growing and processing garlic for about 3 years. In that time, he's seen demand for black garlic soar, and he's not surprised that its unique taste is winning over those who try it.
Sensational. There's no words to describe black garlic apart from sensational. It's a been described as a balsamic sweet type caramelised flavour, and that's a fairly, you know, it can be interpreted quite differently, but it is quite complex and nothing like ordinary garlic. It's actually quite sweet.
How do you eat it?
So we eat the black garlic just straight as a clove, like a lolly. It's that sweet, but we can also, you can use it in sauces, and you can use it in bolognese's, and you can use it in pizzas. Anywhere you would use ordinary garlic, you can use black garlic. You can use it in risottos, and you can stick it in your roast. You can stick it in your soup. Anywhere you like, you can put black garlic. It's quite usable.
So, how did you come across black garlic in the first place?
So, in 2015, I took a career change, and we decided we wanted to do something different. And we bought a small property, and we decided we wanted to grow garlic. As a sort of a bit of a high-end sort of crop that you can grow on a small acreage and make an income from. And we were overseas and we discovered black garlic in a winery of all places, and started to look into it a bit and found out that it is quite good for you. It'll be a superfood, I guess. A lot of medicinal properties, and we decided we'd have a go at just making some of our own garlic black just for our own benefit. And then our friends cottoned onto the idea, and it's like, hang on, we can't keep up, so we've got to keep up with the flow, you know. And so from there, you know, it works perfectly for us being able to value add a product, and we can do it all on a small acreage of land. Yeah, that's how we discovered it, and that's where we're at, really.
So you're fairly new business, having purchased this property in 2015, but now you're telling me that you've got opportunities to export. What's happening?
Yeah, well, we've been running a Facebook page, and a couple of weeks back we had some contact from Portland, Oregon in the States. You know, there's a guy over there who's got a number of restaurants, and they want to use it to make sauces with. So that was a bit of a surprise for us. And then since then, we've also had some interest from China. So we're meeting a delegation from China next week to discuss the potentials to be able to export to Shangshu province. It's a bit of a new area for us, and it's something we're just going to explore and see where it takes us, really. Hopefully we'll get something over there.
What are your markets locally?
So locally, we're selling direct to consumers and into some of the higher end restaurants. It's given it's a gourmet sort of food product, it's sort of targeted to that sort of clientele. But there's a bunch of foodie groups, you know, that they're sort of into it. You know, it's a new product. There's some recipe books around. One in particular called Atotlingli is called. He's a Israeli chef. And it's about using 10 basic ingredients, and one of them is black garlic. So that book is creating quite a lot of business for us, in the fact that, you know, there's a lot of people, foodie groups, that are interested in that and they want to cook these recipes. So, you know, black garlic is one of the ingredients, so they're chasing it down.
According to the Australian Garlic Industry Association, black garlic is a micro market. Between 2,000 and 4,000 kilograms of an entire Australian garlic market of 13,000 tonnes. Black garlic may have moved into the culinary market, but its origins were medicinal.
There's some strong research out of Korea and Japan that highlight the health benefits of black garlic. And, you know, there's research that suggests it's toxic to cancers, and it's great for cardiovascular health and stomach health, and also, you know, beneficial for leukemias and endometriosis and those sorts of things. And for people that are interested, you know, I suggest they do their own research on that. Black garlic's got twice the antioxidants of ordinary white garlic. It's higher in amino acids. Garlic as a herb generally is really good. It's one of the foods that a lot of people go to, you know, during the winter months, you know, to build your immune system. And, so black garlic is just a better version of it, really.
Delicious. So we've just had some with some cheese and bickies. It was very delicious. But the outside of the garlic is white, so it's only when you open it up that it's black. And it also, you know, neither of us here have garlic breath having a chat with each other. How's that?
During the processing of the black of garlic, it undergoes an enzymatic reaction, and then that changes the structure and the properties of the garlic. And that's what takes away the garlic, the harshness of the garlic taste, and it actually changes the whole flavour and consistency of the clove.
This might sound like a regular working farm, but the animals here, including chickens, some inquisitive goats and a mini donkey called Ellie, are not for production, but for animal-assisted therapy.
We had a lady out here this morning, and we were just brushing Ellie, and you know, Ali's almost falling asleep in this lady's arms, but then you also watch the lady's face and it changes as well, because she's now in the moment of, you know, wanting to get this donkey to sleep. So she's not thinking about, you know, the 110,000 things that she needs to go and do when she gets home, because that's making her mind race. She's now in the moment of working with the donkey. She wants to get the donkey to sleep in her lap, and it's just beautiful to watch that.
Hello, I'm Sian Gard here at Flash Farm on the outskirts of Bendigo in central Victoria. This farm is the brainchild of social worker Christy Kemp. 2 years ago, Christy realised her dream of establishing an animal therapy farm, a place where people of all ages could come to work with animals, learn social skills, and connect.
Originally, we started off very focused on kids between 7 and 17, because we'd just seen this big need for kids in that area. We were losing a lot of services for kids. You know, my youngest client's 4 and my oldest client's like 84. I guess for adults, they've probably tried a lot of different environments, and I guess for them, it's sort of gotten to the point where that's not working for them, so let's try something different. And being out here where you can play with a donkey or a cow or whatever while you're talking, and then it ends up being a mindfulness activity and you don't even realise that you're in the middle of a mindfulness thing.
It was a Welsh mountain pony from Christy's childhood which first planted the seed of helping others.
So as a kid, I had a horse called Flash. That's why we're called Flash Farm. We wanted to have his essence in our farm and what we do. I'm one of 7 kids and we all grew up riding Flash, taking him to pony club and things like that. But my dad would take myself and Flash off to riding for the disabled. And it was there where I saw, you know, the difference that this horse could make in kids' lives, or, you know, anyone that came in contact with him.
Later on in life, it was through personal experience that Christy saw firsthand how an animal could make a difference to her son, Will, who was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome.
It had been suggested to us to get him a therapy dog. And when we looked at, you know, one of those animal-assisted therapy dogs, they're 20-odd grand or something at that stage, and I didn't have that kind of money. But he fell in love with this Maltese Shih Tzu puppy. He actually called him Mad Max. So through that, he learnt eye contact. What was the difference between a stare and what was appropriate eye contact? There's such a big emphasis on eye contact and, you know, looking at people's eyes when you talk to them and stuff like that. And this kid just really didn't care about looking in people's eyes. People aren't interesting. But he learnt through working with Max about teaching him to do different things. He worked out that if you want a different reaction, you need to give someone a little bit. So he's learnt you actually don't have to look people in the eyes. You just look at their ear, like the top of their ear. They think that you're looking at them. We could take him on walks and different things, and then it would bring other people around to want to meet him and talk to him. So then that opened up, you know, different dialogue, but it wasn't ever about Will. It was always about the dog. He always had a bit of a common interest.
Christy handpicks all the animals on her farm, looking for qualities of curiosity and inquisitiveness. Cherie Osborne says Flash Farm has changed her 14-year-old son, Ryder.
Ryder has autism spectrum disorder, and he struggled with transitioning from primary school to high school. It didn't work very well. We have huge anxiety problems with people and crowding and noise, and we tried it and it just didn't work. So we moved to room from school. Flash Farm come about and we thought, oh, we'll give this a try, and it's really helped. He's learnt to socialise in a small group. They're working with the animals and he has a purpose out there. So he finds that, you know, he's actually excited to go every day. He's never complained. He's like, we don't have any of that anxiety-driven behaviour that we're having with school. He's just flourished and grown so much out there.
The programs that Ryder takes part in includes looking after animals and learning how to cook.
We went in there not expecting anything, we'll just give it a try, because it's apparently it works with some people and other people, you know, it doesn't. And we just went in and tried it for the first couple of days, and it took a little while for him to warm up, but they don't expect too much either. They understand, and there's a lot of understanding that these, you know, kids that have difficulties and have disabilities and stuff, yeah, they're softly approach, instead of saying you've got to fit this box, you've got to fit in this box and you've got to do this today. And it's sort of more gradual, and it's driven by the kids. They're not pushed along.
Ryder has stepped into more of a leadership role at the farm and is now mentoring younger children.
Sometimes they can be a bit much, but it's fine because they've all got the same problem as me, and I understand that some of them have ADHD and just can't really regulate their emotions because they're so young.
Did you ever think that you would be in a position where you're mentoring other younger people?
No, when I first got to Flesh Farm, didn't think I'd do anything there, even mentor kids. I did at the first start, I was not including myself in the group activities, and I was really quiet, really, really quiet. And I didn't do basically any of the things Christy told me, but now I do it all. I'd just recommend it to anyone. At least give it a try before you tell yourself you're not going to go, because it's really helped me and I wouldn't want to live without it.
Ryder Glover there. He's been benefiting from attending Flash Farm, an animal assistance therapy farm in central Victoria, and that story from Sian Gard. More information about all those stories can be found on our website. Just head to the RN homepage.